This is Whitley Strieber, and this is a Dreamland video presentation. You have reached the edge of the world. Today, we're talking to Mike Dupler. His new book, On the Trail of Bigfoot, Tracking the Enigmatic Giants of the Forest. Later, for subscribers, I'm going to be getting in to this whole disclosure process that's going on, because a lot is changing in the UFO, now UAP world, and we're going to be keeping up with that. We'll have George Knapp and Jeremy Corbell on Dreamland soon to talk more about it. But today, we're going a little bit behind the curtain in a direction we always love to go on Dreamland. We're talking to Mike Dupler, who is not just an armchair detective, but an actual outdoorsman who has been out there looking for Bigfoot for a good long time. Lauren Coleman says, join Mike Dupler on his journey of adventure and discovery for the enigmatic giants of the forest. Okay, we're going to get into this question. Why? What are these things? And why do they never get caught? Mike Dupler, welcome to Dreamland. Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. And I'm so excited because the book, I have to admit, I'm always up for an adventure, God knows. And this book is one. It almost got me out into the forest, I have to admit. But let me ask you, I have a special relationship with this whole subject because Tom, who did the first search for the Yeti in the Himalayas many years ago in the 50s, was a family friend. And so that was a big deal in my childhood. And I'm still very friendly with the family. I had lunch with his niece a couple of days ago. And this question has been an enormous one for me for a long, long time. So let's start about with some of the early stories you have in the book of the Sumerians and Gigantopithecus and Beowulf. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Bigfoot's been around for a very long time in very many cultures throughout the world. There is the story of Beowulf and the Grendel type character that could possibly be a Bigfoot, the way it's described. There are groups on Facebook where they're reporting Bigfoots in England, in Ireland, and across Europe. The Native American stories of the Hairy Man or Sasquatch or Bigfoot of many names go back for centuries. Matter of fact, there was a Viking explorer, Leif Erikson, who had an encounter with a Bigfoot-type creature in the year 986, which is well over 1,000 years ago. So these have been around for a very long time. They seem like they've been around long enough to develop regional traits, like a swamp ape in Florida has different characteristics than, say, a Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest. So it's been in cultures, it's been in stories, mythology, whatever, for a very, very long time.
Now, and Kaidu in Sumerian times, that's 6,000 years ago, 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
They were talking about the Enkidu.
I mispronounced it.
Yeah. Which was a Sumerian version resembling a Sasquatch-type individual, being a wild man who lived away from culture and humanity and was like a hairy type creature, described pretty much as like a Sasquatch type in like creature. I think that they could have possibly come from Africa into the Middle East and into Europe and across the ice flows into North America, which would explain some of these distant stories that are being passed down.
However, if this was something like Gigantopithecus, the great bipedal ape, and it was just that and nothing else, then these stories would be different. We would have remains. We would know they were there. Because a great ape is not going to live successfully in the human-dominated world without being discovered. Before we go there, I was very surprised in the book when you mentioned that Daniel Boone claimed to have killed one that he called a Yahoo. Could you
tell me about that? Absolutely. Yeah, that was a story passed down about Daniel Boone. I believe it was possibly in Kentucky where he had an encounter with what he called a Yahoo, which he described as a large, hairy creature of some kind that he ended up killing.
Yeah, but no remains. I mean, I guess he left it in the woods, not thinking twice about it, probably.
Exactly.
Which is, typical of that day and time. Now, you've been out in the woods a lot. Tell us when you first started going out into the woods.
Looking for Bigfoot?
You must have gotten interested in the woods before you got interested in Bigfoot, and we'll get to that.
Oh, I started squirrel hunting when I was 16. I would go with my brother-in-law. His parents had a plot of land that we went out and we squirrel hunted, and then eventually went into deer hunting, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Where did you live?
I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
Woods. I'm from Texas. And the part of Texas, I mean, there is a part of Texas that actually has Bigfoot called the Big Thicket. But the part of Texas I was from had very scrubby trees. But I was pretty devoted to the outdoors when I was a boy as well, primarily because a lot of my friends had ranches. And, we loved helping with the cattle and stuff. So you're familiar with, now at some point, you get interested in Bigfoot. Why is that?
I watched the documentaries as I was growing up. They had the, back in the 60s and 70s, they had the UFO documentaries and the In Search Of series.
Oh,
if anybody remembers that.
I'm sure a lot of my listeners do too.
And I just ate that stuff up. It was just fascinating that anything like that could even possibly exist.
Tell us about the first time you decided to go out and look for Bigfoot.
Well, okay. I do paranormal investigating. I like to, I do ghost photography, actually. And my daughter and I were in Oregon. We went through the Shanghai tunnels in Portland, which are reported to be haunted. We rented a cabin in a Oregon State Park that was halfway between Portland and the ocean. So one morning we decided we would go to the ocean, spend the day, and we was driving the backcountry roads. And off in the distance in this field, I see these trees stuck in the ground upside down, root side up. Now, I had seen a documentary that's Myths and Monsters of Alaska, and one of the segments in that documentary was Prince of Wales Island, where the locals reported that the hairy man took blown down trees and stuck them in the ground upside down as a territory marker. I have pictures of that in my book, but I was fascinated that this could actually be Bigfoot activity. And when I got back to Ohio, I looked up hotspots on the internet and found out that Salt Fork State Park near Cambridge, Ohio, is probably the hotspot in Ohio for Sasquatch activity. I corralled my sisters to go out with me, and we went there, parked the car. We had no clue what we were doing, and we started walking a trail that goes around the lake. We wandered into a ravine, maybe 100 yards or so, and sat down. We figured we'd just sit there and listen for a while, see what we can hear or whatever. And she looked down, and she said, "That looks like a track." And in the leaf litter, there was a perfect impression of what I would call a Bigfoot track that was 18 inches long.
My word. Now, this is your first incredible attempt.
First attempt. The first time
we
went out,
yes. People looked for Bigfoot for years and never seen the thing. Tom Slick didn't get anything much. That's incredible. And that gets me to another question that we're going to sort of circle around, but I want to just bring it up at this point. There's a definite paranormal aspect to this. And certain people have a lot more of all kinds of paranormal experiences than others. I mean, I'm one of them. I haven't had a big Bigfoot experience, but frankly, if I spent time out in the woods, I probably would. And I have to, and you mentioned ghost photography. So you started doing ghost photography and stuff before you started looking for Bigfoot, right?
Tell
us a little bit about that. When did you start that? And see, we're trying to get into why this happens to certain people. And I'm kind of on a trail of my own. Tell us about your beginning of your interest in ghost photography and the paranormal in general.
Okay. I'm sure I started out like a lot of people watching Ghost Hunters on Sci-Fi years ago when it first came out. And I was fascinated with that. Also, there's a haunted prison not far from Columbus. It's in Mansfield. It's the Ohio State Reformatory. So I decided that my wife and I would go to the reformatory and look for ghosts. It was an organized overnight ghost hunt. And all I had with me was we went to Walgreens, picked up some disposable cameras, and that was about it. So we spent the better part of the evening going to the prison, and I would take pictures here and there. And towards the end of the evening, they would have pizza and drinks for everybody so everybody could take a break, relax, whatever. And after we had pizza, we decided that, well, we're going to go ahead and go. We think we've done pretty good here. We walk out of what's called a bullpen area. We were on a landing looking down into the bullpen. I think I had one picture left, so I snapped it into the bullpen, and then we left. Once I got the film developed, that picture I took into the bullpen, I had caught a full-bodied apparition. It looked like it was sitting in a wheelchair, and I took the picture back on another visit and compared it to where we were at, and this entity was floating 3 feet off the ground. So I was hooked,
yeah.
Needless to say.
You know, you're an attractor. Your first ghost hunt, and you get an incredible picture like that. I'm fascinated by that kind of thing, by the fact that there are certain people who just get into this stuff. It gets into you. So you must have been on a tear by then. Here you are ghost hunting, interested in this. You go ghost hunting. You get a picture. Yeah, and so, I mean, you're hooked now. And, folks, I hope you're hooked, because Free Dreamlanders – you're going to take a look at a few ads or listen to a few ads right now.
My new book, Jesus, A New Vision, is not a Christian book. It is not an anti-Christian book either. Very much not an anti-Christian book. It is new, genuinely new. A look at Jesus in his life and what happened afterwards. His resurrection, for the Shroud of Turin is no medieval forgery. It goes all the way back, and it does record an extraordinary event that appears to have been a body transforming into a form of coherent light. The science is very strong at this point. And yet, how could that be? What an extraordinary mystery. The life of Jesus is mysterious indeed. But the greater part of the mystery is about us. How is it that a human body could transform in that way? Who accomplished it? Why did it happen? What does it mean to you and me about our lives now? Jesus, a new vision, a new window into a very old way of looking at the truth. A way of finding ourselves, perhaps, that we lost a long time ago, but can recover. Jesus, a New Vision is available in Kindle format, as a paperback, in audiobook format on Audible and Apple, and as a Kindle and paperback on Amazon. Do go and get it today.
When you start to ask the question, it unfolds the fabric of space itself, how it's made. What is it made of?
We're not alone in this universe. We never have been.
Alien intelligences have cohabited with us on this planet for millions of years.
We inherited the obsession from the Anunnaki.
Anyone that still thinks that we're the ones that are obsessed with gold does not know enough about the true history of our species, how we came to be here,
and the conditions that brought us here.
We are not unique in this universe. Extraterrestrials do exist. We are, so to say, the copies of them.
We're talking to Mike Dupler, his new book and very fun book, On the Trail of Bigfoot, Tracking the Enigmatic Giants of the Forest. Oh, yes, I love it. It's so much fun to do this because there's something out there all around us, not just Bigfoot, ghosts, aliens. It's all real. It's all real in some way, in some way. Now, Mike, so let's circle back now to your life in Bigfoot research. We know that you, like it turns out, your first ghost hunting experience, you get a picture. Your first Bigfoot hunting experience, we left you looking at a track. Now, where were you? Now, what happens next?
Well, after we found the track, we just looked around a little bit more and didn't find anything else. So we left for that visit, but we came back a month or two later and went to the same spot, and we was looking around and we didn't see anything. We were, like I said, we were in a ravine, and we noticed on top of the hill from where we were at were these bent trees, which didn't look quite natural to us. So we climbed up on top of the hill, and we found a Bigfoot structure, which is a beam like this with logs around it. We looked around. There was no root bases. It looked like these had been placed where they were. So I took pictures. We looked around. There was some suspicious tracks, but nothing definite. The structure was absolutely amazing. I took pictures of it, and on subsequent visits, I took pictures of the same structure, and over a period of time, I noticed that items had been added and items had been removed from the structure, changing it. And I made a determination that this could possibly be a form of communication where they're using this as a billboard. And if they change the structure of the logs or sticks or whatever, it could possibly change the message they want to convey.
Now, let's go back to this word structure. How did you know? This is the first time I've ever heard of a Bigfoot structure was opening the pages of your book. How did you know what you were looking at?
Okay, well,
tell us a little bit about Dr. Ian Redmond and Bigfoot, the Definitive Guide.
Okay. He was on Vancouver Island, which is off the coast of British Columbia. And he was looking for Bigfoot activity, whatever he could find, tracks. And he found a Bigfoot structure on Vancouver Island that was very similar to the one that I found in Ohio. His determination was that the male Bigfoot created this as a show of dominance or a show of strength, that he can break logs and assemble them in this manner. But it seems like that type of structure that he found and the type of structure that I found are common across the country.
Yeah. Now, yeah, exactly. And I'm looking at the picture and our video viewers are looking at the picture too. And folks, what I'm seeing, for those of you who are on audio, is basically what looks like a group of saplings or thin trees kind of put together in a cross formation, angled together and set up between two trees. So it's definitely not something that fell together like that. That's quite clear. But couldn't it have been just made by people?
Well, that's the question. And when you look for a structure such as this, the structure that I found, the structure that Ian Redmond found are very, very similar. So if someone was going to construct these, they would have to know about them in both locations. Now, I was on a bear hunt in Nova Scotia. We were on what's called Queensland, which is the same as National Forest here in the States. And what he does is he cuts a trail through the woods and puts up a bait barrel. He puts donuts and stuff like that in to bring in the bear. But he hides the entrance from the road so nobody goes back there to contaminate it with human scent. I was in a tree stand in this area, and I looked to my right, and there was a stick structure. Very similar to what I found in Ohio, very similar to what Ian Redmond found on Vancouver Island. And I could tell you for a fact that nobody had been back there. And my guide had no idea what a Bigfoot structure was. So this was definitely not hoaxed. This was an actual structure built by something.
Now, you mentioned in the book that going back to the first structure you found 6 months later and finding changes in it. Now, I wondered if where Dr. What was his name? Dr. Redmond got his idea that it was some kind of territorial based thing, because couldn't it be a form of communication? You speculate that about that in the book.
Well, if they... Okay, Ian Redmond was a primatologist, and he was looking for evidence of a gorilla or for a gorilla activity, and he was assuming that this structure was built as a form of dominance,
right,
by a male.
As
exactly.
As through the eyes of a primate specialist.
Exactly. That's what he was looking for, so that's what he's found. But the structure that I found, which had changed over time, if you consider that these creatures are scattered, and if they have a focal point of communication that they can alter the message and leave a new message or that type of thing, then that would be ideal for them to communicate without having to get together to actually do the communicating.
Well, you know, you say in here that you think the structures are used for communication. And yeah, now
some of them are, yeah.
That gets me to the next big issue, which is we have just the most, just traces of the existence of Bigfoot. I know Tom Slick came back with what turned out to be, he thought it was the skull cap of a Yeti, but it was eventually identified as something else, something normal. And I guess probably the Sherpas, you know, were upset that he hadn't found what he was looking for and tried to give him something that would make him happy. That's very much part of that culture. And so in any case, subsequent to that, there have been, oh God, thousands of attempts to find Bigfoot. And people have said, well, I'm going out there with a rifle and I'm going to shoot one, so forth. Daniel Boone at least claimed to have succeeded in that. So, see, conceivably it's possible. But then again, Daniel Boone was not the most reliable witness that the world ever. He might have heard about these things and sucked up a little corn liquor and then decided, well, damn it, I'm going to say I killed one. Very possible.
Very possible.
Okay, though. We're getting now into the paranormal end of this because tell us about the evidence that does exist, that's real. There are the good tracks and any other evidence, physical.
You have the tracks, the tracks that have been cast. I have actually a cast of a handprint. You have the vocalizations, the whoops. My sister and I have actually been growled at on two separate occasions. Oh, it was. If you can imagine Godzilla growling at you, then that's what this sounded like. But there is absolutely nothing in the Ohio woods that growls like that. I mean, nothing.
Well, to describe the sound, if you could.
It just went from low to high, and it was like reverberating. It just, you could almost feel the sound hit you. It's just, some people could refer to as maybe an ultrasound, which I don't think this was quite an ultrasound, but it was along those lines, but it was an audible sound.
Now, Bigfoot sounds have been recorded and extensively analyzed, haven't they?
Yes, yes. A lot of the sounds come back as unknown or unknown primates. I think what's going on there is we don't have the database to properly identify various sounds made. There are Bigfoot recordings, but I don't think they put them in their database as an actual sound to use to identify anything because it is a cryptid type creature, an unrecognized creature. They don't want to add something that could be construed as incorrect.
You're talking about the database of primate sounds.
Exactly, that they compare Bigfoot howls and sounds to determine that it's something other than what they have in their database.
Now, what about things like scat and hairs. Scat, folks, is poop, if you don't know. just to be clear to the city dwellers what we're talking about.
Now, I have never seen scat that I would consider to be Bigfoot scat in the woods. Now, there is a museum in northern Georgia, a Bigfoot museum, where they say they do have Bigfoot scat, and it is a log probably 3 foot long that had to come from something.
I think a little big.
But I don't think they determined any DNA from it or anything not. Like that. But not that
I wonder if they still could. If it's not fossilized, they probably could.
I would think, yeah. I don't know how long DNA takes to degrade, but I'm sure they could find
something. Still be, well, I don't know about scat. Now, let me backtrack here. I think that the trouble with scat is it's going to have a lot of DNA in it from everything that the creature has eaten. So you're probably not going to find DNA scat in scat that's usable. Now, guess what, Free Dreamlanders? You've got to scat for a few minutes because we're taking a break. We'll be right back.
There's a new world coming if we can take it. What does that mean? The first part of the message is if we can take it for ourselves on our own terms. The second part of the message is, can we bear the newness and the huge expansion of human consciousness that is going to be involved? Can we take it? A new world. It doesn't mince words. It tells the good, the bad, and the ugly like it is. And it leaves a message behind. Can you do this? Do you want to? Do we have an alternative? Right now, at this point in history, mankind is either going to get a lot bigger or not. I choose to go forward. I choose to live for and in the future. I choose the future. A new world. We can take it. Available in hardcover, softcover, audiobook, and Kindle.
We're talking to Mike Dupler, his really enjoyable adventure on pages, on the trail of Bigfoot, tracking the enigmatic giants of the forest. Now, we've talked about Bigfoot on Dreamland many, many times. Not so often with somebody who's been as intimately involved with Bigfoot as you have. So, but let's go on a little bit now about hares. There have been some hares found. That have the, any of them played out as really not a known species?
There was a DNA study done by Meldra Ketchum. She's from Texas, who had people donate hair samples that they considered reliable Bigfoot hair samples. And she determined through this DNA that Bigfoot was a human relative. Apparently a human female copulated with a unknown primate 10,000 years ago to create the Bigfoot race as we know it today. But it's been determined that this could be flawed because of sample gathering, how trustworthy the samples were that were gathered. There was another test done by a British scientist using hair samples collected from around the world. And each and every sample collected turned out to be either bear or deer or something along those lines. There was no definite Sasquatch DNA obtained from these samples. But I'm sure there's hair out there somewhere that people's gathered and it's in their closet or in their bottom of a drawer somewhere, something like that, people who don't have the facilities or the resources to test the DNA on these type of
things. Yeah, and also there's this elusive quality to this that we talked about at the beginning. The sense that it is a not quite a physical phenomenon, that this is something that comes in and out from another world. And, you know, when the scientists first arrived on the Skinwalker Ranch, there's a famous story. We've told it on Dreamland a million times. I won't go into any detail. A huge wolf was seen in a paddock with with some goats by the family just before the scientists arrived, and they shot at it. The wolf jumped out of the paddock and ran into a marsh. The scientists later found and made casts of the animal's footprints that just stopped in the middle of the marsh, and it was a 300-pound animal. In other words, it was no ordinary wolf. It was a dire wolf from the Pleistocene, or from a parallel universe where the Pleistocene hasn't ended. So could it be that they are coming in and out from another realm of some kind?
I don't believe so, because they have been around for so long. Another thing would be, what would be the physics of going from one reality to another reality? Or where do they come from? Do they come from this reality or the other reality? Jeff Meldrum made a comment one time that he doesn't think that this could be interdimensional because it is so well adapted to this reality, which I go along with that. I've actually seen one. I've been close to several. I've found their tracks. I think these are flesh and blood animals. But I can't say for sure that they're not interdimensional until we get a body or a carcass or something along those lines to identify it, and then we can assign attributes that way. But I can't say they're not interdimensional. All I can say is I don't think so.
Incidentally, folks, if you want to, you mentioned Melba Ketchum. She was interviewed on Dreamland by Linda Moulton Howe some years back, and that's available in the archive. The archive's full of fascinating Bigfoot interviews and Bigfoot stories. So if you're not a subscriber, you might be tempted to take the plunge of the 5 cents a day or whatever it costs and subscribe just to explore these stories, because they're so fascinating. Now, I don't know if, you know, I'm more inclined to think that there could be a paranormal aspect to this. And the reason is that we've never found a single carcass or anything. But if it's not paranormal,
right,
then they have, in effect, natural technology that enables them to remain very, very hidden. And now when I say technology, I don't mean some kind of strange technology. I mean just they have excellent hearing, eyesight, sense of smell, and a high level of intelligence. If they have all of those things, and I don't say necessarily a human level, but somewhere, say, between a gorilla and a human, or a capuchin and a human, and all of that skill and all of that equipment and their knowledge of the woods, they might be able to stay hidden. But it might be getting harder, because we're getting bigger and bigger. There's more human beings out there every day. So what do you think about the possibility of Bigfoot eventually being found?
It's going to happen one of these days. There's a lot of technology out there looking for them, especially drones. You get a LIDAR drone, you might be able to spot a clan of them. It's just a matter of time until something like that happens or until they find a body. But until then, we won't know. Now, there are stories of what's called MindSpeak. No. Are you familiar with that? MindSpeak is some researchers in the field have experienced like a telepathic connection with Bigfoot. One of them is Survivor Man in his Bigfoot series.
Are you familiar with that? But tell us. I mean, if I say yeah, and then we just go on, my listeners are going, what? So tell us about it.
A friend of mine on Facebook actually experiences this. And I have thought, okay, I do ghost photography. I do ghost hunts and that type of thing. I cannot feel a ghost. I cannot feel the presence. I'm not aware of ghosts in any way, shape, or form. I just don't have the abilities, which to me is probably a good thing. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking there are people who are aware of ghosts. They call them mediums or whatever, or can feel the presence or are sensitive to them, okay? That type of person could be the type that can receive mind speak from Sasquatch or Bigfoot. They might have the ability to do that, but it takes that ability to do that.
Well, you know, I'm not going to go down this road today, but there are people who can do that. And I'm well aware of some of them.
Right.
And I'll tell you right now, they are absolutely in control. You don't see them unless they want you to, because they're going to know who you are and where you are long before you show up. If this animal has that ability, then basically forget it as far as anything is concerned. You're never going to find them, I don't think. And now, here's another question, though. Why are they so shy? Are they afraid of us? Do they dislike us, do you think? Do you think there's a sense of threat out there at times, for sure?
Well, one of the possible explanations for the extinction of Gigantopithecus is that Homo erectus hunted them to extinction. That's a theory that's in the scientific community. It could be that eons ago, the Bigfoot had the same type of situation to where they were hunted by humans and pre-humans, and that's just a memory that they passed on. Like most cultures have a flood story. A legend of a great flood, right, like in the Bible or Mesopotamia, that type of thing. And that could be the same type of memory that they're passing on.
So
that could be why they're so elusive and so aloof from humans, is because of repressed memories of eons ago they were hunted by humans.
Oh, that's a long ago. Down, Boone was telling the truth. Now, you mentioned a very interesting structure. The trees in it are sort of bowed over, and you say that you think it might be an artistic structure. Could you explain what you're talking about there and where you're going with that?
Okay, this was in Ohio, and my sister and I found arched pine trees. There was a section of pine trees that were just arched over the trail. Now, the pine trees around them weren't like that. It doesn't snow that much in Ohio to create a snow load for them to do that. It just looks like they were just arched over. And one thought that I had was they could have used these when they hit the ground on the other side. They could use those for like a shelter or something. but over time, going back to the same spots, the pine trees were woven together at the top, which is probably 10 feet off the ground, which there's no reason to do this. It's nothing to do with survival or that type of thing. It wouldn't be a shelter. It has to be possibly artistic expression. It looks
and
great.
No one would. I don't think people could do it without a lot of ladders and things.
It's back in the woods. You would have to have ladders back there. There was no ropes involved or any bindings. They were just woven together.
And there's no way that could happen just naturally, I'm assuming. Or am I? No.
No, absolutely not. The wind's not going to do that, and snow's not going to do that, and weather's not going to do that.
One of the furious Bigfoot shows I've ever done, because we're talking now, folks, about something that really was created by someone else that might have seen with his own eyes.
Exactly.
I find that really wonderful and fascinating. It's why this show exists. In many ways, is to, you know, to challenge the edge of the known. And, you know, you're out there. How did it feel when you first found this?
One thing that I thought about was the many structures that they make. Okay, the one that we found on top of the hill that they changed over time, I think that could be possibly communication. But some of the structures are just, there are so many different types of structures. I mean, the variations is incredible. They have so much imagination to do these type of things. And some of the structures that I've seen that do repeat could possibly be like homage to maybe a nature spirit or that type of thing, where they're honoring nature, because that's exactly where they live. That's their environment. That's their home.
If they have the ability to read thought, then I know I'm not even going to get into this because it's a real sensitive subject, but let me just rephrase this. If they have the ability to read thought, then they also would have a completely different relationship with this universe than we do. They would be very different inside in their minds and hearts, because they would, for example, be able to, they would live in a kind of weave of beings. In other words, they would all be aware of each other's presence. And so far as they could read distant thought, but I have enough experience of this to know that for people who can do it, at least, distance is significant. In other words, they're not going to do it over 5 miles, but they might do it over 500 feet. So you could be looking at a creature with extraordinary capabilities, extraordinary sense of smell, extraordinary eyesight, extraordinary hearing, great physical strength, power, and speed, and the ability to detect you long before you arrive on the scene.
Now, I don't think that they would have the ability to understand our words,
that is,
reading our minds. But I think they could possibly understand
people intentions. Always think that reading thought has to do with understanding words. It does not. It's a very, very different process. A person can keep their secrets and still be read, believe me. But they would be able to detect that human presence, definitely, from a long way away. Now, what about, you make a point in the book regarding these structures about ritualistic behavior. You talk a little bit about why you think that might be the case and why it's important. And if there's an artistic expression going on, then, you know, you're certainly not talking about an ape. You're talking about something else.
Well, humans are very ritualistic. I mean, everywhere. Yeah, it's everywhere from day one. I'm not saying that Bigfoot has human tendencies, but it could be a tendency of intelligence to have, like I said, structures that honor possibly nature, that type of thing. This is their environment. They take care of it. They respect it. They honor it. They cherish it.
It's what they have. They don't have this. They don't have anything.
Exactly.
And they know that.
Right.
You're out there with a gun looking for bear and deer. And a lot of other people are out there with guns. That must be very concerning to them.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure it is. Come deer season, I'm sure they're way back in the woods, you know, back where humans don't
go. Listen, I used to like to walk the woods when we had our cabin. There's a lot of woods around there. I would not walk them during deer season, even in an orange vest, because people get too excited and they see some movement in the brush and they start taking shots.
No, absolutely not.
Although I have to say that the woods behind my house were not very much frequented by hunters, because the stories about those woods in the neighborhood were pretty scary. So we have a possibility of ritualistic behavior. We've got a theory, at least, as to why they can't be caught. That's not a paranormal theory. Now, I don't agree with you. I think there is a paranormal component, personally. But that's, you know, we're not here to necessarily dance to the same tune. And you have more experience with this than I do, and you may very well be right. Tell us about, you've had some actual encounters now. You've taken pictures on there in your book.
I've had several encounters with them. As far as the paranormal aspect of it goes, I was investigating one time and my shutter motor went out on my point and shoot camera. So I was using my night vision camera in a daytime mode, the camera that I hunt ghosts with. And I took pictures in a Bigfoot active area. And this is in the book also. I took a picture of what looks like a Bigfoot face impressed in the environment. And I'm thinking, well, this is a Bigfoot active area, and I'm catching this Bigfoot face impressed in the environment. What I thought was this could be possibly a form of remote viewing that they could use. I know the CIA and other organizations theoretically have used remote viewing over the years to spy on the Russians and the Chinese and vice versa
is the important part. The Russians have taken this a lot farther than we have, unfortunately for us.
Right. But if we can do this, then you would think that this could possibly be primate activity. Not exclusively for us, but as a primate, we can do it. Another intelligent primate could possibly do it too, and use like a remote viewing type as a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah, well, our remote viewing project was shut down by Congress because Christian fundamentalists in Congress thought it was demonic. Unfortunately, the Russians did not shut theirs down, and which is going to, if what has happened ever comes out, it's going to prove to be a pretty big problem. Now, this creature, what do we know about its habits? Like, what do you think they eat, and how big are their territories? How many of them are out there? It's a lot.
I think there's a lot more out there than people
think.
Well,
if they can read minds, if they can thought read, and they can therefore and have all of that detection capability, they are in control of their situation in ways that we don't understand at all. Exactly.
Now, exactly.
But what about their habit? Like, what do they eat? Are they carnivorous or?
I'm sure they're. Well, one school of thought is they rely on deer. There've been a lot of suspicious deer kills in Bigfoot active areas. Deers are Mother Nature's grocery store.
Sure are. Listen, I grew up in Texas, where deer season meant venison season and sausage and all kinds of things. Tragic. We lost our entire herd of axis in the freeze that happened a few months ago. Apparently, they think it's between 80 and 100% of all axis. All the axis on any of the places of friends and family all died. But in any case, the whitetails didn't because, and they're still around. Tell us a little bit about some of these unexplainable kills, some of these strange kills.
What they find is the legs of the deer are broken. Like they could take a deer down possibly with a rock. They have tremendous upper body strength, and they've been known to throw rocks. They could take a deer out with a rock from a considerable distance and to stun it, and then when they reach the downed deer, they break the legs so they can't run, and then they process it from there.
When you say
there's been a lot of stuff.
What are the carcasses like?
Stripped pretty much like a predator would.
No sign of tool use. Stone tools.
I think it's just bare hand. Mm-hmm. But they leave pretty much the innards and eat, you know, the good stuff, hindquarters, meat, backstrap, that type of thing.
Instances of reports, credible reports, that suggest that they might sometimes come closer to the human community, like in the edges of towns and things like that. Because I've read stories about people who saw them like right on their front porch and stuff.
The ones that I have encountered have not been far from human activity. They have not been far from roads, trails, parks, whatever. Because I don't go that far back in the woods, especially if I have my sister with me. The two occasions we were growled at, we were on top of a hill right above the main road going into the park. They weren't far from human activity, but they, on top of the hill from where we were at, they could see for quite a ways. So there's no way you can sneak up on them, especially if they were using extrasensory perceptions.
Yeah, well, I think that thought reading isn't an extrasensory perception. It's simply a perception that the people who don't have it choose not to believe in. But if I don't have it, certainly, but I mean, I've experienced it. I've been with people who do have it, and it's creepy. But it's real. It's very real. You try playing cards sometimes, somebody like that, you'll have a lot of fun, believe me. They always know where you are. They don't necessarily know your hand, but they know what you think about it for sure. So you can't right. get very far with that. Although I have to admit, it was a hilarious experience, and I wish I could go into it more deeply, but I don't want these people to get pissed off at me. So, because they're not, I haven't seen any of them in years and years, I have to admit. But they would come up the cabin every once in a while in upstate New York. And they were just people, but they just had extraordinary abilities. Okay, right. So what do you think the future of Bigfoot research is? We're just coming sort of up to the end of our hour together.
I would say that the future of Bigfoot research would be technology and boots on the ground, looking for evidence and using technology to find more evidence. That would be my opinion. Like I said, the use of drones that type of thing, even using like Google Satellite or something to pull up an area and actually look for anomalous things in that area. I think it's going to boil down to pretty much to technology.
In a way, I hope it remains a mystery. It's funny, but I think that if we identify them and locate their habitats, that's probably a pretty tragic thing for them.
Absolutely.
We are encountered after all.
Exactly. Unless they could move further into the woods away from us. But I think that they're close by is to keep an eye on us. I think they have us pretty much pegged. I have a theory that when somebody sees a Bigfoot in the woods, when they report it, then what do you have? You have 20 people in the same woods looking for Bigfoot. I think at times they let themselves be seen in one area as to draw people away from another area that they don't want us in, where their young could be or habitat or something like that.
It's diversionary tactics. Because they,
exactly,
whatever they are, whether they're paranormal or not, they definitely know their forests really very well. Very indeed.
Exactly. Well,
I think that, as I say, we have an area of disagreement, because I think they are paranormal in the sense that, the same sense that the wolf that showed up at the Skinwalker Ranch was considered a paranormal animal. I think there are creatures who have evolved an ability to pass back and forth between this universe and the parallel universe as a survival skill. And I think those creatures probably some of them also have the thought reading. That's my own opinion. But that doesn't mean I don't think that we will find them here. And here's my question, my last question. If we find a Bigfoot, a real Bigfoot, and capture it or bring in a corpse, what do you think will happen then in the human world?
The government will probably take it and hide it.
I wonder if that's true. I think it might, but it would do that. Why would it do that?
There are different theories out there. One theory is to protect the logging industry, which I don't think that's a valid reason, because I'm in Tennessee and they do a lot of logging here, and there are Bigfoot here. I have an active area that I research, and there's logging going on there. They simply move to areas where it's too, where the slopes are too much for equipment to get into. So those areas aren't logged, and they know that. So they stay more in these areas than, say, a flat area where they're going to come in and take all the pine trees out.
And on that note, Mike Dupler, the author of On the Trail of Bigfoot, Tracking the Enigmatic Giants of the Forest. May you prosper in your journey, Mike, both in the exploration of ghosts and in the exploration of Bigfoot and all the other fascinating things you do. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to say goodbye now. Subscribers, stay tuned, because I am going to go through where we are now with the coming DOD revelations and what I think is probably going to be revealed and what it all means and what some of the reaction responses to it are. It's going to be an important half hour for sure. So, Mike, thank you very much for being with us on Dreamland.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.